love to hear that whistle, because when Too Short says blow the whistle, that means it's time for another edition of In and Out of Sports in the Coach's Corner with Coach Butch McAdams. And this show is sponsored in part by Horton's Funeral Services and Dr. Edward T. Buford, and as always, powered by our partners at the AfricanAmericanAthlete.com, and that means writer, columnist, golfer extraordinaire, my producer, Rick Hampton Sr. Well, folks, I have a very, very special guest. This guy means so much to me and others. And when I think of our guest, several words come to mind, but one in particular. Rick, hit it for me, please.
When most people think about philanthropists, or even if you were to Google it and see what comes up, you'd see the historical context of, you know, Rockefeller and Ford, right?
People are viewed as needing to be rich. Multi-billionaires, millionaires, famous people.
It feels a little bit like a itchy sweater in a way. Think of Bruce Wayne's parents.
I think the term philanthropist has a connotation of old white man.
Maybe like a MacArthur Foundation or a Rockefeller Foundation.
A philanthropist, rich, wealthy, on TV, or organization, not just a regular person.
This guest is a philanthropist. He is a community leader. He is an entrepreneur, but most importantly, he is a tremendous human being. Without further ado, let's bring in Randolph Horton, a.k.a. Reds Bowman, and I call him the point guard. And after tonight's interview, you're going to know why I call him the point guard. But point guard, welcome into the Coach's Corner, man. Thank you.
Thank you, Coach, for having me on, and it's a pleasure and an honor to be
and
here.
Yes,
and
folks, if you
be
don't
able to tell
know,
my story.
Yes, and folks, if you don't know, for some of you listening around the country, when you hear me at the beginning of the show say this show is sponsored by Horton's Funeral Home, yes, this is the Mr. Horton, Randolph Horton. And let me start off with the question before we chop it up. We are in uncharted waters with this COVID-19, this pandemic. It's affected and had an impact on a lot of industries and entities. But briefly talk about the impact that it's had on your business, the funeral service business.
Well, Coach, you know, we're on the front line, too. I mean, they talk about the healthcare workers. We're actually on the front line because at our responsibility after the death, the virus is, you know, we found that the virus is still active. And but our services are the same. We have not changed how we serve our people. It's just that the laws and regulations have changed. It makes so you can only have a certain amount of people gathering, but we strive to render the same services. And I know I tell families, I know it hurts that the law said only 10 people could be at a gathering, or 50 people, up to 50 people now, but our services does not change, because we're going to serve from our heart. Regardless of what happens, we're going to continue to give the same service.
Yeah, absolutely. And just from a historic standpoint, and no one better to speak on this than our guest, Randolph Horton. But years ago, in the 30s and 40s, African Americans had few industries to participate in. The hair care was one, but the funeral business was another. From a historic standpoint, talk about African Americans in the funeral business the last 50, 60, 70 years.
What was the question? I didn't quite hear you, Coach.
No, I was saying that for so many years, for example, my grandmother
mm-hmm.
God rest her soul, had a funeral business in a little town in Georgia by the name of Hartwell, Georgia. And I was told that years ago there were two industries that blacks were prominent in. One was the hair care industry, of course, with Madam C.J. Walker, but the other was the funeral business industry. So talk from your perspective of blacks in the funeral business.
Well, you know, we had the funeral business was in, and how the blacks, African-American, got started in the business was during the Civil War.
Okay.
People dying on the battlefield, and we were recruited to gather the bodies up and bring them back to their homes so they could be properly buried. And I guess during that time, watching the embalmers who at that time, they learned how to do the embalming, so that became a profession that they picked up. And soon after that, I guess they went into that profession themselves. And you know, and back then, you know, a lot of times white America didn't want to touch the African-American body. So this was a chance for us to grab hold of this profession and make it something that benefited us. I know I told Dad Horton one time, I really didn't like the idea of sitting here waiting on the phone to ring to make a living. And he said, well, son, you didn't start this. You just make this ministry. And that's what I've been doing. I've been making a ministry to serve my people. And that's how I got started in it.
Wow, and you've done exceptionally well. All right, let's get into it from the Randolph Ridge Bowman aspect. Let's talk about growing up in D.C., playing multiple sports for the Boys and Girls Club and the Rec Center. How did it start?
Well, Coach, I started out when my family came up from the South, Edgefield, South Carolina. And we came up, you know, parents. My dad worked for his brother in a construction business. And so, you know, we were not out like the kids now in the playground playing sports. So, you know, at that time, there was that opportunity.
No.
So, basically, we stayed in our block playing, and at a certain time, we had to be in front of the house when the streetlights came on.
Mm-hmm.
But as we got older, and I know we were living up here, and I went to Petworth Elementary, and we moved from Petworth to Northeast Washington, right there, 423 Fifth Street North, right there by Stewart Junior High School.
Oh, okay.
And as we got a little older, we were able to venture down to Sherwood Playground.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
Matter of fact, my oldest brother John, he was a couple years older than me. He played on the basketball team at Stewart Junior High School.
Mm-hmm.
Him and Joe Smith, Gaylord Hogue, and I did not play basketball in junior high school, but I watched the three of them, and Gaylord Hogue and John, Joe Smith, they used to have epic battles with Tom Little at Hines.
Oh, my goodness.
And Joe Smith would be the leading scorer. My brother John would be the second leading scorer, and Gaylord Hogue would be the third leading scorer. And rebound. Gaylord was here to shot. Underneath that basket was unstoppable. He was really fantastic. Melvin Jones, Joe Rice, all of them, they had a really good high school team coached by two white gentlemen, Mr. Zeke and Wallowack. I do remember they tore it. And only opportunity I had to play basketball at Stewart was we had section games right after lunch. We everybody run to the gym. We had 15 minutes to play a game of basketball and then back to class. And that was my ninth grade year, and then getting ready to move into the 10th grade year, and we moved to Northwest, so I could not go out for the students. We moved, so I ended up at Shaw Junior High School.
Okay.
And playing, but I was still coming back over to Sherwood, and at 12 and under baseball team, and this one gentleman was the coach. His name was Alonzo Lee. And I don't know, after you, I think you might remember Willis Lee, who, and we'll talk
yes.
about him a little later.
Yeah.
Alonzo Lee was the coach, and he coached us and taught us how to play baseball. And me and our team, and he taught us to be champions. I mean, and at the game, there would be crowds around the field just watching us play, and we were winners, and he pushed us and pushed us to be the best that we could be. And the thing that I found this out later on in life, that he coached, and he did not get one penny for coaching. He did it for the love of trying to help us young men grow up to be better people. And I wanted to publicly let him know that he is one of the reasons for my success, because he got me on the road to being an athlete. And athletics has been what's made given me my legendary status. And Mr. Lee is one of the main reasons, because I never would have got into sports if it had not been for him. And sure, with playground.
Excuse me, you brought up a great point, that there were so many, most if not all, of the coaches back then, and we were young, we didn't realize it, but they were all volunteers. I mean,
volunteers.
You talk about Mr. Lee. I had Mr. Bradford, Lawrence Bradford's father, Mr. Thomas,
yep,
Willis Thomas.
Yep.
They were all volunteer coaching. And they just did it, as you said, for the love of young people and the love of sport. Please continue.
Yep. Yeah, we had the playground director was Nick Turner. He was one of the directors there, Alonzo Lee. And then one of our association members, Ray Savoy, he worked at Sherwood. And,
and
he raised us. He brought us. I mean, these were the guys that nurtured us and made us who we are today, along with our parents. And so from there, playing 12 and under baseball, then 14 under, 16 under. And then the Metropolitan Police Boys and Girls Club opened. And number 9 was our club. And it opened up right in Stewart Junior High School. So with that, Mr. George Cole was the director, Mr. Hawkins, Mr. Ross Cole was the football coach, and he taught me how to play football in the position of quarterback. And I ended up being a pretty decent quarterback for the boys' club. Mr. Robinson taught me basketball. I'd already learned baseball from Mr. Lee, but Mr. Hawkins was the baseball coach there, but Mr. Robinson taught me how to play basketball. And between Sherwood Playground and Number 9 Boys Club, that my nurturing was done there to make me the athlete that I am today, and I've been. So at Shaw Junior High School, Shaw didn't have a team. So they had a little small gym, a little small ceiling, so they couldn't even. So, but I was out on the playground one day, lunchtime, sitting on the ground, and the guys are throwing the football around. The ball came over to me. I'm sitting on the ground. I grabbed the ball, and I just flung it back. And a gentleman by the name of Sid Banks.
Big Sid Banks.
Big Sid Banks. He saw me throw the ball, and he called Mr. Leo Miles and Mr. Luther Banner. He called both of them, Leo Miles up at Bell and Luther Banner at Dunbar. And he told him, he said, I got a kid who can throw a ball. He's sitting down and threw it 30 yards. So they called Mr. Miles called me. Mr. Banner called me about coming to play for them. And, you know, Leo Miles, you know, he had the great teams at Bell High School. But my brother John had played at Dunbar, and he had done so well, linebacker, naming the paper for making these he was a skinny guy, and he was sacking quarterbacks. And I was so impressed with him that I wanted to follow him where he went. So I went to Dunbar behind him. And that's how I ended up at Dunbar playing football. And first of all, you know, Dunbar was good for ROTC.
Yeah.
And we used to practice every morning and drill. And Mr. Major Rumsey, we called him. He Captain Rumsey at that time. He was our instructor. And they had an event called Individual Manual Arms. And I'm a 10th grader, my first year. And I entered that competition, and I went all the way, and I got second place out of all the individuals, the men in the school. And
wow.
Some guy told me that I really sure wasn't going to let a 10th grader be the senior out. So, and I say that to say that I have seen God bless my life
sure.
so tremendously.
Sure.
Everything that I've started out to do, God has led me to be successful. So from doing the individual, so I went on to the football team and did well, name in the paper, write-ups about how I played and throwing touchdowns, and then basketball. And I played on the 10th grade team. I played on the JV. I started, was the best player on the JV team, and Wendell Hart, Bill Ote, and Gaylord Hogue, all of them on the varsity. So the second half of the season, they brought me up to the varsity. And I got in the game, and it was like nervous butterflies. I was so nervous. I was dribbling the ball. I was all out of bounds with the ball. Just so many people, you know, all these people screaming and yelling. And we played a game at John Carroll, the John Carroll Christmas Tournament. This was the 10th grade year, and I was not getting any playing time. But Cadoza was playing, and Billy Gaskin, Len Ring, Vaughn Kimball, all the guys on the team. And the crowd was all over me. The crowd was so large, people were almost on the floor. And I saw Billy Gaskin, the ball was going out of bounds, and Billy Gaskin ran and got the ball. It was falling in the crowd and turned around and shot. You know how Billy had that high skyscraper?
That's right.
And that thing hit the bottom of the net, and cameras were clicking and flashing. I'm saying, good God, this was just super excitement. So
yeah.
Next year, I was an 11th grader on the second team. So we go to the same John Carroll Christmas Tournament. We played the Mather, Morgan Wooten, you know, and you know, everybody knows his legendary status.
Sure.
And he had on that team was Sid Catlett, who played on that team that beat Al Sender, Orbit Nash, James Brown, Bruce Mitchell.
That's right.
So all of them on that team. So the starter was out there, and the Mather was beating up on us. So the coach put in the second team, which we were the running team, and we got in there, and we coming back. We brought us back. But the starters on the bench problem, so the coach finally put the starters back in, so the Mather beat us by 7 points. So the next game, I think I scored 2 points a game. Next game, I scored 4 points. We beat Gonzaga, somebody like that. So here I'm sitting in the stands for the consolation game, which be the third game of the tournament. And I'm sitting beside a guy, and the guy said to me, he said, man, you're going to make all the tournament. I said, I scored 6 points in this whole tournament there. I had two guys on the team averaging double figures. He said, you're going to make all the tournament because you broke the Mather's famous press. I said, press? What press? I just knew with nobody going to steal the ball from me and nobody could stop me from bringing that ball up court. And Morgan Wooten was just super impressed with my ball handling skills and how I played tight defense. And I was told by a guy when I first went out for basketball, he told me, I'm going to tell you how to make the team as a point guard. If you see your forwards breaking down the floor, don't hold that ball. Pass it to them. Get the fast break going. get the offense going before the defense gets back and set up. And I play that way today. And,
wow.
I tell the kids today, I say, the way to stay on the floor is to play good defense, because every coach wants somebody that can stop somebody.
That's right. But now here's the point. Hold on.
Mm-hmm.
I want our listeners to hear what you just said. Folks, he said, when I play today, he didn't say when I played or when I used to play. He said, when I play today, and what he's saying is, still plays the game and plays it well.
Yeah, I just thank God that, you know, I've had no serious injuries and I'm still playing. We had a 16 over league and we were champions. We had 15 over league, we were champions. And it's just that. And they call me in the league, they call me shutdown. Because if I get on you, if you averaging 20 points a game, when I get on, you're going to average 10. Cause I'm okay. And there's no magic in it. It's just that as playing you man to man, the object is to keep the ball out of your hand. So I'm going to play
right.
you so tight that they can't pass you the ball. So that cuts
right.
down your touches. So that cuts down on your scoring. And that's just the way I play. I pride myself in defense. And like I say, my senior year, I made all first team all in a high, and took Dunbar back to the playoffs. We had not been to the playoffs since 64 when Jim McBride and Loyal Dempsey and Mucci and all them were on the team, and they played Cadoza, Bo Scott, them for the championship, and they lost. And then,
Aaron Webster, good friend Aaron Webster.
Aaron Webster was on that team. Who else? What's his name?
Billy Gaskins was on that team.
Billy Gaskins was on that team.
Yeah. So,
Terry Goins, all the others. And they had a marvelous team. And we had a marvelous team. It's just that Bo Scott, they tell me Bo Scott got hold of it. He took Cadeau to victory. But they had not been to the playoffs. So we took Dunbar back to the playoffs that year. We met that famous McKinley Tech team with Ronnie Hogue and Randolph Appelmalam and Kevin Tatum and Tim Bassett. Mike Bizard, all those guys. I mean, they had a monster team. I mean, 6'7", 6'9", and our center was 6'1". But we were a running team, and Coach Dean from Cadoza, he used to marvel at how we run up down the court, man. Bill Butler, he was at, you know, Cadoza. I mean, number two boys club, and he would say. If I had these kids here, he used to marvel how we used to run up and down that court, fast break defense, and so this is how we played, and I just thank God for all the success that I've had as an athlete, and like I say, I'd show my children and my friends my scrapbook of all the newspaper writer from the news at that back time was the News, Star, and the Post, and write us about, it really felt good. You wake up in the morning and you grab the newspaper and just write up in the paper with your name on it, you know, and it was really a good feeling. But I don't take it lightly. I really thank God for the favors that He's that in my life, and for the people that have helped me to get where I'm at.
Let me ask this question. And we're talking about an individual who played and stood out in three sports, baseball, football, and basketball. Today is an era of specialization. And you've got young student athletes at the age of 12, 14, only playing basketball or only playing football. What are your thoughts on that?
You know, it really puzzled me how baseball just disappeared, because at one time, baseball was the number one sport that we played as African Americans.
Yes.
And here, baseball, if you look at baseball there, if it wasn't for the Dominican Republic, there's no people of color in that game. And it's a lot of revenue being made by those guys playing that game.
Look.
And I don't, you know, I mean, every playground, every rec center used to have a baseball team. The boys and girls, they used to have baseball. But all of a sudden, those teams are gone. They don't have those, they're not pushing those teams anymore. I mean, you look at the playgrounds now, the baseball diamonds are gone. I can go down Southwest right there. I think it's Jefferson right there coming down.
Yeah,
off. They have a baseball diamond there, but most of you feel the baseball diamonds are gone.
Yeah. I'm looking at, and piggyback on your point of baseball in terms of a longer career, guaranteed money, and big time. Today, one of the few African Americans that's playing the game, his name is Mookie Betts. The Dodgers signed him today, listen to this, to a 12-year, $365 million contract extension. 12 years.
12 years.
And his salary was $27 million a year. And,
yep.
and you're not getting hit, per se.
Nope. No major injuries. You're right.
No, mm-hmm. no. So, I mean, this is a game. And let's talk about how you really, of the three sports, baseball could have been your best sport. You could have been the next Maury Wills if you had stuck with baseball. Correct?
Well, you're correct. I had a coach at Dunbar. Don Porter, and he coached Maury Wills at Cadoza, and he was the athletic director, and he knew I was coming to Dunbar, and I played that first year, and having all that fanfare with the football and the basketball, and I go out here to play a baseball game, and there's no fans in the stands, and me being a little, you know, flare-headed and not understanding what's going on in my life, I was looking for that attention. Now, that game was not going to give me any attention, so I stopped. And he called me to his office one day, and he told me, he said, "Son, you broke my heart." I said, "What, Mr. Porter?" He said, "I was getting ready to retire, and I decided to stay on to coach you because you had the potential to be the next Maury Wills." And I say, you know, back, I said, "Yeah, well, I don't want to play coach." But he showed, and we know now, Maury Wills is a Hall of Famer.
Well, he should be in the Hall of Fame. Not in.
Well, he's a baseball Hall of Fame. He didn't make the Hall of Fame yet?
No, that's a travesty because for 3 years,
yeah.
Maury Wills was one of the most, if not the most dominant player. He was the MVP, I believe, in 1962, I believe. And from
stealing bases. And
yeah, he set the record and you know, won championships and all. He should be in the Hall of Fame, but, you know, for political reasons, he is not. But
they named the Banneker Field after him down there, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yep.
And then in football, you were the quarterback, and one of the greatest compliments that I've heard about you, Mr. Horton, is that the great Cornelius Green, the first African-American quarterback for Ohio State, won a Rose Bowl. And Corny, we call them flamboyant, said, "Hey, I used to stand on the fence as a youngster and watch Reds Bowman quarterback." That's a heck of a compliment.
That was it. And he said he really watched it and admired. He said, because I was a scrambler. Because I had a tissue paper liner, as you call it, so I was scrambling for my life.
They did they did that Ole or Matador blocking.
So I was running for real. and that's why I was, and Corny came in and he was flamboyant and he scrambled and he did it because that was his style. But yeah, he did say that he watched me from the fence, and I really take that as a great compliment. Yes.
Yeah, and the Coach's Corner is a special individual to me. He is Mr. Randolph Horton, a.k.a. Reds Bowman. And you play three sports. You stand out in all three. But you decide that you want to play basketball in college. Why did you decide on basketball?
Okay, I had college offers of football and basketball. And I weighed about 155 pounds coming out of high school, and going to recruiting events, going to the campus and watching. And I'm looking at these big linemen, 200 some pounds. I said, "Man, I have to go play football. These big guys." I said, "I'm gonna play basketball. I'm not gonna go at these big guys," because I was getting beat up enough in high school. And I look at these big college ball players. Nah. I'm going to stick with basketball. So I went on to basketball. I don't know if you remember John Sewell.
Yes.
John Sewell, he came out of Dunbar, too. And he was the first African-American to go to this small Catholic college in St. Benedict's, Indiana. It was St. Benedict's College in Ferdinand, Indiana, I'm sorry.
Wow.
And he was recruited by Mrs. Adams, and she was the director up at Merrick's Boys Club, Christ Child Settlement House up there on Mass Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
And she recruited him, and he recruited me and Joe Styles to come out there with him. And so it was another African-American player, Dave Farrell, who came out of a high school in Indiana called Indianapolis, Washington. And one African-American cheerleader and another African-American. So it was six African-Americans in the whole school. And 1968, right after the 1968 riots, and I wrote an essay on the 1968 Olympics. And with the guys protesting with the black gloves. And my teacher was so impressed. And she took the essay, she went down the hall showing all the other teachers and talking about, look what my basketball player did. They were super impressed with it. So they were so impressed. They said, this is your day. You do whatever you want to do. You don't have to go any more classes today. And then they said, we're having a community day, I think a week or so later. They said, you can invite any guest that you want to invite. 1968, I invited Dick Gregory to this all-white institution.
Wow.
And, you know, 1968, you know how Dick Gregory, he was on the hunger strikes and, you know, very radical. And he spoke, and there was a few other blacks because it was advertised that he was coming, so they had people from other parts of the state coming out to the event. So Dick Gregory makes a statement. He says, you don't want us black men to look at your white women. But when we turn on TV, all we see is white women. And you talking about some folks that were upset. So they told the president of the school, they say, any other speakers you invite, you got to get it approved through the board of directors. And she refused.
Mm-hmm.
So they started pulling their money out of the program. So the first thing to cut was the athletic program. So, you know, that was it for me.
Wow, that's an interesting story right there.
Yeah, and when I saw Dick Gregory before he died, I remind him of it. He said, I remember. He had to fly in from Evansville. And matter of fact, I was out there the same time that Austin Carr and Sid Catlett and Bob Whitmore, and they were all out at Notre Dame. And Ed Else was at San Diego State. Ed Else was at? Trying to think where he played, but they played against each other. And,
yeah, Ed went to Utah, I think.
Utah State. That's what Utah.
Yeah.
And I watched them play. My Ed Epps was playing against Austin Carter. I said, these are my homies. Look at me. I mean, they playing against each other. So
yeah,
that was during that same time. So I left there and came back home, and I got accepted at the University of Maryland, and at that time, Federal City College, with UDC now.
That's right.
And at that time, Sam Jones, who is a all-time great Celtic ball player and one of the NBA's greatest.
That's right.
He was the athletic director, and eventually became the coach. So I played for him at Federal City College, and him and I, we're good friends today. I talked to him a few months ago, and
yep.
and so I played at Federal City. And I asked Sam, I said, let's give a camp at Sherwood Playground. And that's where, I grew up at Sherwood, So we went over and we did the camp, and Sam was showing the kids how to shoot the ball. He's sitting on the ground and
yeah.
underneath the basket and shooting his jump shot and showing the kids how to get the backspin on the ball. So after the camp, I went to, at that time, Hansberry and Ball were running Sherwood. And I asked him, why don't we start a basketball tournament?
Wow.
And they agreed. And I don't know if you remember, the Sherwood tournament was birthed, and it was almost like the Rutgers tournament. I mean, when you talked to Andrew White the other night. That was the tournament. You talked to Andrew White the other night, you were talking about at that time, the playground game was our NBA game time. We did have Johnny Jones, who came out of Dunbar, and DeMatha, who had played for the Celtics for a while, and then Ollie Johnson had played professionally, and Dave Bing was there. But it was still not like that Sherwood tournament. We had some of the greatest ball players out there. That first year when we first started, we had Melvin Crabhouse. He put a team in, and he had guys like Jerome McDaniels and Eugene Oliver and Ducky Vaughn and Steve Higgins and Wim Worm and Huckabuck. And then they had that great Southeast team, Biggie Cunningham, Fred Cunningham, Slim Barnes, Bobby Goins, Willie Daniels, M.V. Shaw, Stanley Parham,
Boy,
Mike Savoy,
yeah.
and Sterling Savoy. I mean, they were awesome. I mean, they were awesome. Then Tony Usson had a team in there. Tony Usson and Frank Williams and B.I. Smith, Barry Jefferson, Glenn Price, Milt Lundy, Lloyd Mays. Lloyd Mays was on that team. Where I first met Lloyd Mays when he at the Sherwood tournament.
Lloyd is the ambassador of basketball. I mean, he's played at Sherwood. He's played at Chevy Chase. I mean, he is just an ambassador of the great game.
He played
of
overseas too.
Absolutely.
He played professional
absolutely.
Overseas. That's right.
Yeah, and man, you guys, and this is interesting as we continue our conversation in the locker room with Randolph Horton, A.K.A. Reds Bowman, and I never knew the origin of the tournament at Sherwood, but I knew about it. And people would say, man, I'm going over on the fence. I'd say on the fence.
You're right.
Wait, what you mean? Man, I'm going over Sherwood on that fence. And
on that fence, I tell
you.
That 9th Street fence,
yeah.
that 9th Street side. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you
yep.
can see some of the great players. Looking at
even,
some
I mean,
of
you had Bobby Damage down there. Bobby Damage played, Moses Malone, Adrian Dantley. There's a guy come out of Virginia Essex, JoJo Hunter.
Essex Thomas.
You talked about Stanley Milton the other night. Stanley Milton. I mean, Chicken Breath. I mean, you had everybody. I mean, and they bring up Willis Lee's name again. Willis Lee was the play-by-play commentator, and you could hear him all the way on H Street. He would draw the crowd when they hear him on that mic, man. I tell you, it was outstanding. It was outstanding. Everybody talked about that Sherwood tournament, and I just thank God that I was one of the ones that was instrumental in getting it started. And It was really one of the greatest tournaments I've ever had. And we had plenty of tournaments around this D.C. area, but Sherwood was the tournament.
That was the tournament, and it was the precursor, so to speak, of the Barry
yep.
Farms League, which is very prominent now, which,
yep,
you know, Miles Rawls does a great job as the director and on the mic. But before the Farms tournament, it was, as you just stated, the Sherwood tournament.
Yep.
Now you go
yes,
to Federal City College, which was mm-hmm. relatively new school. The great Sam Jones is there. And Federal City at the time was very unique because you had a lot of older players and students.
Yep.
And talk about some of the people who came back to play at Federal City, both football and basketball. I mean, it was like a who's who of former All Mets.
I'm telling you, I know the football team, Mr. Brooks, he was coaching over in McKinley. He came there
yeah.
and he coached the football team. Lawrence Moten was the quarterback. They had Bogey was a running back, and Big Mo Warren and Peter Bug. And I'm trying to think. They were just awesome. And they were in that club league, and they were undefeated.
Yeah, Dunmore.
They beat
Drew Dunmore.
Dunmore, Andrew Dunmore's on the team. They beat everybody, man. I mean, it was no small victory. They were whitewashing everybody.
That's right.
They like you say, they came. Like you say, they came back after a lot of them were married, families. But they came back and with the basketball team, we had Lawrence Bradford, William Brockenberry, Roger Trueheart, all those guys had gone off and they came back to Federal City to play at Federal City because they were at home. Randolph Hurst was on that team. Delano Dunmore was on the team. The guy out of West Virginia, William Harrison, the Terrible Turk, they used to call him. He was on that team. And so it was an enjoyable time. And we got our education.
Yes.
That was the most important thing. We got our education, too. We played ball, but we got our education.
Mm-hmm. Was it coincidental that, and we're going to talk more about, we're going to talk about how you were able to utilize your skills from sport into what you're doing now. But my question now, Mr. Horton, is, was it coincidental or on purpose that in all of the sports you played the positions of leadership? Quarterback, that's leadership. Point guard, that's leadership. In baseball, shortstop, catcher, leadership. Was that coincidental, or that was something that you believe that the coaches saw in you and say, hey, we got to put the ball in this young man's hand?
Well, I think it was something that was just coherently in me, and I'm a firm Christian believer that God brought it out of me and enabled these individuals to see it in me,
sure.
and put me in position to put it to use that it will help the whole team, not just me as an individual. It put me in a place where I could be better used to be the catalyst to help the team. And believe me, when I was high school, I was the leading scorer, senior high school, in my senior year, leading scorer and leading an assist. I enjoyed giving that assist out. Man, or the point guard, or I mean the two guard, for him to get an easy basket. And so, you know, it's not about me. It's about us as a team, and this is what I believe then, and I believe now. You win as a team, not as an individual. You get the individual accolades as an individual, but you don't get the wins. We have to learn how.
At the beginning of the show, I played people, various people talking about a philanthropist and the various definitions that people have, you know, multimillionaire, white, this, that, and the other. But anyone can be a giver. You have been a community person, a philanthropist. What is the foundation of your giving? Because everyone who's in the position that you're in don't have that mindset. So talk about the origin of why you are so giving.
Because, you know, I remember I was coming up, and I got out of college, and I wanted to be this, I majored in physical education, then I changed it to rec because I wanted to be a coach. So when I got out of college, I went to work, I think his name was Smitty over at Keller Miller. I worked over there about a year, and then Metro opened up, and I applied to be a Metro bus operator and got that job. Mm-hmm. And was making good money.
Sure.
And I had a young man who grew up with me over on 7th Street Northeast, and he was like a younger brother or younger son named Johnny Blake. And he used to hang out. I said, Johnny, man, I like this job, but I was putting some money aside. I say, I really want to take my money and find somebody and it has a business or want to help start a business and join force with them and do something bigger than what I'm doing in driving this bus, something that I can be more valuable to helping other people. So at that time, as a gentleman, I was working at the 14th Street garage on Metro, and a gentleman named Bob Jenkins had the grocery store on the corner. And he came to me, somebody told him that I was interested in investing, so he came to me about investing in the store. So I did. And then I brought in another two friends of mine, James Briscoe, who, as a matter of fact, we drove the bus together. We had an apartment, we were rooming together. He's right now, he's the godson of one of my sons. Mm-hmm. And another friend, Nathaniel Waller, who was working for the Washington Post. And we invested in the store and changed the store from a grocery store to a delicatessen seafood carryout. Briscoe was making this great seafood salad, and we started these foot-long hot hash smokes and crabs and everything. And we had lines out the door. And Metro bus across the street, the guys knew from driving the bus, so Briscoe and I drove the bus, and Briscoe grew up in that neighborhood up there, so we had the neighborhood, and we had people come from Clinton, Maryland to buy this hot hash smoke. And it just, the people just drew to us. But there was a situation. I needed a cash register and a refrigerator unit to keep the food cold. And I applied for it, and I didn't have enough credit to get it. And Daddy Horton, I had asked him, and I'd just been knowing him probably 6-7 months, asked him, would he co-sign for me to get this equipment? And he told me yes. And I told him, I'll pay you back. He said, no, I don't want you to pay me back. I said, when you get off from the store, I want you to come around to the funeral home and help out and pay me back that way. So I went around. I was cleaning up. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's all I did, clean up. And I was ladies from downstairs on my knees with a brush cleaning the bottom of the toilet. And I didn't see him. And him and the guy named Mr. McLean, they came up behind me, and he said, Mr. McLean told me, he said, Mr. Horton told me, he said, I ain't never seen a kid work so hard. Look at him. He said, I need to take him off the cleaner, put him on driving the limousine.
Hold it right there. Hold it right there. That hold it right there. That point that you just made is so important to the listeners. In that, what did Martin Luther King say? And I'm paraphrasing. He said, "Whatever you do, be the best at it. If you are a street sweeper, be the best street sweeper." And there is, again, paraphrasing, but in the Bible, there's a passage that says that if I can trust you with little things, then I know I can trust you with big things. You work so hard in cleaning the bathroom that the powers that be management saw how focused you were and how committed to doing a job. They say, well, look, if he can do this cleaning a toilet, what else could he do, you know, driving a limousine or in the business office, et cetera? That's very important. That's a very important point. Please continue.
Yeah, so that went on, and driving the limousine and pretty soon making funeral arrangements and making removals, bringing the decedents into the funeral home. And the next thing I knew, he was asking me about adopting me.
Wow.
And me becoming his son. And I went to my dad, who was still living, and it's the Bowman's, it's six boys. So the Bowman name wasn't going anywhere, so I asked him, and Dad eventually agreed. And the name was not important, but I saw it as an opportunity.
Yes.
For me to do something that I could reach back and help my people. And God gave me, like I say, God gave me that vision. Okay, this is an opportunity. This is a door I'm opening for you, because I want you to continue to be a blessing to my people. So I did that, and I got in school, studied, and got my degree in mortuary sciences. Passed my board exam, and I went to him and showed him my results. And his words to me, he said, because, I mean, he's up in the age, he's 90-some years old and gone, all his friends are gone. And I truly, but I was, I took a study course with a group down in John Tyler University. And I told him, I said, I got to pass this exam, because I truly think that he's only waiting for me to be prepared before he transitions. I passed the exam and showed him the results, and his words to me said, "Well, son, now you don't need me anymore."
Hmm.
I say, well, no, I still need you to give me that wisdom. He said, "You got your license already. You don't need me anymore." I passed that exam, and 3 weeks after I passed the exam, he closed his eyes and went to sleep. And I said, "Good God, look at God." Waiting for me to get myself together. And he said he's done what he was saying to do, so now he's passing, just like Moses charged Joshua to carry the people to the promised land. I look at that as him charging me to carry the ministry next step of the way.
Wow.
And
I just want to, as you expound on your career in mortuary science, funeral business, but I just want to piggyback again on your experience in sport and connect that with how even today it assists you in your day-to-day business in terms of your compassion for people, your entrepreneurial spirit, etc. Because I know that a lot of the things that you used in sport as a quarterback, as a point guard, as a baseball player, I know that you're utilizing them in a different way, but utilizing them nonetheless in your day-to-day life as we speak.
Well, I tell people all the time, Coach, that God didn't bless anybody to keep it to themselves. Like you say, as a point guard, the assist that I made to the other player helped the team win. He makes a basket to help the team win. And the same thing, I believe, in my professional ministry as a funeral director. The team is what's important. And I tell my people all the time, we're in this together. This is not about me. I say, God has blessed me, this is the analogy I use. I say, He's blessed me with just about everything that I need and just about everything that I want. But God wants us to give back. And it was a spiritual song we just sing in church that you can't be God's given no matter how you try. Mm. And the more you give, the more He gives to you. And I've actually seen God bless my life because I have a giving spirit, and it's just ingrained in me, and I get the greatest joy out of helping somebody else, and I get all kind of letters and phone calls about, and people say, "Go to Hort, because he's going to help you."
That's right.
And I tell people, God has never told me no, so I will never tell his people no.
Wow.
If you truly don't have it and you need it and I got it, I will promise you, I won't tell you no, I will take care of you. And I do it. And we've had tough times in the business when I first took over, and I had to tell my staff, I said, look, God did not bring us this far to leave us. Trust in the Lord. Be of good courage. Do his will. And I know he will not let us down. And he has not failed us. I mean, he has brought us full circle. Back in 1999, there was a situation where the pastors were having a situation where they had older members who had purchased graves back in the 50s. And at this time, they needed to use the graves and, you know, opening and closing out of their container. They needed $2,000-something, and they didn't have the money, so they were going to the churches, asking the churches to help them. So they called me to a meeting at Shiloh Baptist Church at 9th and P and asked if there was anything that the funeral directors can do to help us with this situation. And I say, Pastor, yes, the only thing we can do is get our own cemetery. Because at that time, the major corporation was buying cemeteries, so, you know, these big conglomerates, you know, ain't no compassion for them. You pay or else.
That's right.
So I rallied a few film directors and a few pastors, and we started on a venture to get us in there. We purchased some land and got to a certain point, and my people would not go any further. And it just stressed me out that we come this far and we walked away. So for a few months ago, I was not sleeping and stressed. My wife, she called my pastor, Bishop Alfred Owens, who was so instrumental in my life. And spiritually, he has been my spiritual advisor. And he's a wonderful man, him and his wife, co-pastor Susie Horn.
Yeah.
And he told me, say, son, let it go. Let's pray on it. And like everything, God will get us through this like he does everything else. So. I mean, I think you remember a couple years ago I had the seizure, and the doctor said that distress,
absolutely,
and lack
yeah.
of rest and all of that brought the threshold down so it bring on the seizure. So I let it go, and I had a lady call me. She said, son, and I go, he said, evidently that's not the cemetery God wants for you. And just, let me see, October, September last year, I got a letter in the mail from a gentleman and his group who wanted to sell their cemetery that they had started in 2015. And I said, to God be the glory, cemetery already developed and was at a price that we could afford, Horton themselves could afford to purchase it without bringing anybody else in.
Wow.
So we did that in October of last year. We purchased that cemetery, 94 acres, a beautiful piece of property. Now, here is the, and I talked to the lead minister today, and what I have proposed to them, that we still need to go a step further, and some of these ministers, they remember the project. I say, I want your minister to be stockholders in this cemetery. I said, not individual. Because if you become an individual stockholder, you're going to put the money in your pocket. But if the organization is a stockholder, then the money's going to go to the organization, and the organization will take the money and reach back and help the community. So they're putting together their nonprofit. Right now it's about 50 members, would be like 50 churches. And I told them like this, I don't want your money. This is honest. I do not want your money. I'm going to give you some of my own personal shares in the cemetery. All I want you to do is to bring your members to your cemetery when they need it. And for me, this is just a blessing. I don't need the money as an individual, but this will be able to help us help ourselves in our own community. We as African American, we generate over $1 trillion a year in revenue, and we don't let it go around in our community enough to help us. We've got to do more in our community to help us economically. We got to create job opportunities for our people. So this is what God has put on my heart in my little corner of the world, what I could do. And I just hope that somebody else will see this idea and do more. I mean, we've got to do more. We've got to help ourselves before we can expect anybody else to help us.
That's right. That's right. Randolph Horton, a.k.a. Reds Bowman, is in the coach's corner. Boy, this is special. I knew it would be. But now talk about not just being an entrepreneur. You talk about giving back. And I know you're a very humbled individual. But for the sake of this interview, let's talk about some of the other organizations that you are part of. You mentioned one of your origin venues, Number 2 Boys Club. When they were on the brink of closing its doors, you and Coach Thompson and Lonnie Dorn and others went down to save it. So you're on that board. You're vice president of our organization, the DMV, Athletes in Action. You know, you're part of the African American or Black funeral directors, on and on and on. As successful and as busy as you are, you still have time to give back to other organizations. Talk briefly about some of the organizations and your mission.
Yeah, I made it a point to be a part of as much, I would say, this organization called International Cemetery Crematory Funeral Association, the National Funeral Directors and Morticians Association, the Canaan, which is the crematory organization. I'm a licensed cemeterian. I'm licensed as funeral director in Maryland, D.C., and Virginia. And like I say, with being a national member, I'm connected nationally. Anytime there's a need in another state, I can call one of my colleagues in another state to get their assistance. I mean, just in all these organizations, and I felt so touched. One of my meetings at the National Association, the executive director, you know, they asking for different donations to help to do this and do that, and a lot of members are slow to get up and make the donation. And there's a director, her name is Wim, she called. She say, "Mr. Horton, will you please stand up?" She say, "I'm asking him to stand up because every time we come and ask for help for any project, he always stands up and makes his appeal, his donation." And I just believe because these are our organizations. We have to support it. If we want it to grow, if we want it to be there to help our children and our grandchildren, we have to make it stronger. And it just so happens that it's economics in this society that makes things stronger on that level. So we can't keep it ourselves. I say a lot of time I when I'm talking in my closing remarks, I say, when I die and I go into that grave, people are not going to remember anything I've done for myself. But believe me, what I've done for others, they will remember. And there's a word that says, only what you do for God will last. So helping his people will last. And this is what I grew up on. I grew up as a Christian young man. My parents made us go to church. Well, no, you didn't have a choice. You went to church every Sunday. And we had that foundation. And this is what I grew up on, and this is what I live on. And I truly tell people, just do God's will and watch God bless your life. And you will see the salvation of the Lord in the land of the living. And I have truly, truly, my people, seen the salvation of God in my life. He is truly a blessing. All I'm trying to do in there is to continue to be a blessing to others. And the more he gives to me, the more I'm going to give to others. I come home sometime, and I come down North Cap, and I see some of the homeless, and it just crushes my heart. And I, a few years ago, I said this to myself. We have all these African-American funeral homes. If we were not selfishly thinking, we could go and get land and build a facility that we could house the homeless and pay for it. And don't worry about who's going to get the credit for it. You're helping God's people. And I'm making it a mission of mine to try to do something. One of my colleagues out of Texas called me today, and he said they're doing something in Texas where they're taking pods, you know, those canisters that on the ship, and somehow they're cutting them in half, and they're making them out of a room and fixing them up with running water and everything for the homeless in Texas. You know, it's just somehow, some way, we've got to do more. There should not be homeless people living on the street. Because this country is too wealthy. Some of them you're not going to be able to say, but it's some out there that's out there on tough luck. So this is in my spirit, and it's God-given, and until the day I die, this is what I'm going to continue to do is give back. They say pay it forward. Mm-hmm. And I just ask people just to continue to pray for my success so I can continue to help others.
Also, I would be remiss if I did not let our listeners know, besides giving back, besides of being a philanthropist, as we said earlier, but here's the other thing that I admire you. You give people second and third chances in terms of employment. If someone has had a bumpy road, but needs a fresh start, you're there. and you employ so many people. And so you're covering it on all fronts in terms of giving, in terms of money, time, but also giving people opportunities. And talk a little bit about that.
Well, I always say if it wasn't for God's grace and mercy, it could be me. We all deserve a second chance. I mean, the word said God gives us chance after chance after chance. We're nowhere near as great as he is. So if he can do that, we can do it. I mean, if you give a person a chance and if he turns it around, okay, now if he continues to mess up, you eventually got to let him go.
Sure.
But some people have just fallen short in life and they need a helping hand. Not a hand out, but a hand up to get back on their feet. And I'm going to do that. I've given some guys a job. I had a guy from the Washington Post call me and want to know, why would you give him a job? If it's one of your friends, would you give him a job? And he would not answer me. But, I mean, we can look at some of our leaders now, how they giving their buddies second chance. And you know, so, we have got to understand. I mean, I haven't been perfect. Believe me, I've made mistakes.
We all have.
But God knows my heart, and he's given me the opportunity to make it right, and I made it right, and he's blessed me so I can be a blessing.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's talk about your wonderful. And folks, look, nobody wants to die, okay? But if when that time comes, I've always said go to Horton's and get that last ride in that bad, we call it a short. Now, I don't know, Rick in Detroit, what y'all call it, or people listening around the country, but the old school term for a bad ride wasn't a car. Wasn't a vehicle, it was a short.
Short.
Man, talk about that bad, I'm talking about awesome ride at Horton's.
Well, I saw this vehicle at a convention in New Orleans, and it's called a Rosewood Prison. It's a 1932 replica, big bay window on both sides and big open window in the back. And the color is blue and white. And I tell you what, when I brought it back to the funeral home, I had people stopping. I mean, they were saying, man, I'm telling my family right now, this is where I want to come because I want to ride in that car. And it's just, you got to brand yourself to make yourself stand out amongst everybody else, you know. Even in this is like I said, I didn't like to wait for somebody to die to make a living, and Dad told me to make it your ministry. This ministry, everything I can to make it as appealing as I can, if that's what you want to say, because this is the last thing that this person can do for their loved one, and I want to make it as perfect as I can. And like you say, the hearses and the limousines, Rolls Royces, and this vehicle here, the Rosewood, and it's like I'm not a funeral director, so to speak. I'm an event planner, and this is an event that we're putting on for this family, and we make it great. We make it great.
And not only, folks, does the car look good, but when you walk out and when the door opens, music automatically plays. But I love it because normally you would have to pay an arm and a leg for that. But what's one of your mottos? Service? Dignity
service
at any cost.
Yep. And I make it affordable because
yes, you do.
I want people to use it. If it's priced too high, it's going to be sitting there. So I want people to, because the more people see it, the more people are going to use it. And I've had people calling for it. Matter of fact, I need a couple more because people this week, they want it, and it's already gone out. So I just thank God for, again, and I can't say it enough. I thank God for what he's done for me in my life. He's blessed me tremendously to be a blessing. And I thank all those that are around me that are helping my wife and all that helping me to keep me going to serve the people. So all I say is to everybody, just pray for me, and I'll pray for you.
Well, brother, you know I'm praying for you, and full disclosure, and I'm thankful to God as well, and I give him all the glory, as you know. And people will say, man, I really enjoy your shows on Sunday. I'm enjoying the podcast, and I thank them. But I always tell them, God first, but there would be no In and Out of Sports if it wasn't for Mr. Randolph Horton. And it was coincidental. Well, no, it wasn't coincidental. It was God's plan.
Yeah.
I'm walking into the cleaners on the corner of Georgia Avenue and Sheridan. No, Rittenhouse, excuse me, at the time.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah.
And you're coming out, and, you know, we exchange, hey, man, how's your game? How's your jump shot? And you said, hey, I heard you on Coach John Thompson's show. You're doing a good job. And I said, well, yeah. Thank you, but I'm thinking about getting my own show. And you just said, hey, come by tomorrow morning and talk to me. Didn't bat an eye, didn't hesitate. And you said, I'm going to support you because I believe in what you believe in, but I want you to do one thing. And my marching orders from Mr. Horton was this: tell our story. Don't let anybody
yep.
else tell the story. You tell the
yep.
story.
Document our history. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why is that important?
Document our. Yeah. Because if, like I said, if you don't help yourself, nobody else will. So nobody's going to tell our story. Other people are going to water it down, and not. I mean, I tell you, when you was on Coach's show, it was probably being financed by somebody else who didn't want to spend their money telling our story. That's what I truly think. Might not be true, but so we had to support our own. So we had to put the money up to tell our story, and then we can tell it the way we want to tell it. So
yeah.
This is what I truly believe. We have to make us out of what we want us to be. Because everybody else is going to give you as much as they want to give you. If we do it ourselves, we can go as far as God will let us go. And he wants all of us to be blessed. He
sure.
wants all of us to be blessed abundantly, because everything on this earth belongs to him.
Sure.
And he didn't want this person to have this much and that person to have that. He wants all of us to have what we need. No, everybody's not going to have the same thing, but he wants all of us to be blessed abundantly and have what we need to survive in this, his world.
You know, I was
we
told
have got
one time. Excuse me, go ahead, continue.
Go ahead, Coach.
No, I was told one time, someone used the analogy of a catcher, and they said a catcher doesn't have two mitts or no mitts. He said a catcher has one mitt and a free hand. That means so he can catch some and he can throw some back. And
yep.
while listening to you, I'm thinking of that. But now I would be remiss for folks who don't know Mr. Horton, you're listening and you're saying, man, this is a great guy, which he is. But I got to tell you, now we've talked about his giving heart, is entrepreneurial spirit, his athletic prowess. But now we got to talk about this guy. Ever since I've known him, since Federal City, back in the early 70s, one of the best dressers in town. I mean, one of the best dressers in town. And it's almost like all of the people who work for you, especially the guys, it's like a uniform, nice black suit, beautiful tie, white shirt. And I'm saying, man, every time I see you, it's like you stepped out of the old GQ magazine. Talk about the foundation of you being or having a passion for fashion.
Well, let me tell you where it started. It started with my older brother, John.
Okay.
And John,
yeah.
Was the he was the dresser in the family. I mean, junior high school, I mean, he dressed. I mean, he worked and he spent his money on his clothes. So I got that from him. Now, in the business here, it was always, the film director was always looked to be next to the pastor, the minister. And the minister was always dressed up. So this is the same image that we had to portray as funeral directors. I tell my staff, I say, if you go to the hospital to pick up someone, loved one, there's two different firms. One firm comes in, guy got on little hat cocked to the side, jeans and a shirt with no out, hanging out, and the other firm has guys with suits and ties and everything. Who do you think the people are going to want to pick their loved one up? That one that's dressed neatly and nice. Because if you look like that, you're going to have my loved one looking like that. So you got to portray an image because people are watching. And they see what you do. They hear what you say.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to look right, talk right, and walk right. Yeah. But that dressing thing, that came from my biggest brother. And I had to give him all the credit. I mean, I tell you truly, man, we have a family that's been really a tight family. And he's been one of my inspirational persons in my life is my brother John.
Yeah, John's a great guy. John's a
great guy.
Pretty
great
good dancer, guy. Too, man.
He's a marvelous dancer. I mean, he could do it all.
Yeah,
he could do it all. I mean, when he was in junior high school, he didn't play high school basketball. When he was in junior high school, man, you talking about a guy could shoot the lights out.
Mm-hmm.
He wouldn't know it, but he was a phenomenal dresser and still is.
Absolutely.
That's where my dressing came from.
Yeah, well, we got about 5 minutes left. And, of course, you're familiar with the show. It's your show pretty much. But I always will have the guests leave our listeners with some words of wisdom, parting shots. We call it wow. And so I'm going to give you the ball, and you got 3 minutes to use them as you see them.
Well, Coach, the only thing I would say to the people is that we have got to do more. I mean, I look at the protest that's going on and the Black Lives Matter, and we're at odds because of the white police that are killing the black men. But but we have got to do more when we kill one of us.
Yeah.
We've got to start speaking out when we kill one of us. We got to stop killing ourselves in our neighborhood. And we need to protest that. Amongst ourselves, we've got to do more. We've got to show more love for each other. Now, it's one thing to say you love me, but show me you love me. And I love all of God's people. I might not like what you've done and what you're doing, but I love you because I'm a friend. Nobody's born bad. Your environment, how you grow up and how you train, that changes you. And we have a lot of kids out here. They really have not been blessed to have the right upbringing. But we've got to find some kind of way to change the way we're going.
Mm-hmm.
Because God is truly not pleased.
Oh.
This virus and all the stuff that's going on. Yeah, I'm a staunch Christian. I believe God can do anything. He could stop this virus if he wanted to.
Sure.
But he has not chosen to do that because he wants to open our eyes and for us to see that we've got to change the way we're going. Or he's going to shut this earth down because it's his and he can do anything he wants to do with it.
That's right.
But we have got to do better as his people. Treating each other better.
You know, well, you know, normally at this time I would tell our listeners about Horton's Funeral Service, conveniently located 600 Kennedy Street Northwest. I would give them the number 202-829-9000 and tell them who to ask for. But no better person to talk about Horton's Funeral Service, what you do, where you're located, than Mr. Horton himself, Reds Bowman.
And also with the funeral home at 600 Kennedy Street, Northwest Washington, D.C. And then, again, our cemetery now.
Okay.
In Calvert County, Peak Highlands Memorial Gardens. And you can Google it and see we're at 3270 Brooms Island Road in Port Republic, Maryland. And I say to my people, help us so we can help you, because the more that comes to us, the more we're going to give back. And this is our cemetery. This belongs to us, belongs to no other organization. So if you can see it, see your way to helping us out, please, because we're going to help the people. And I say to everyone, to God be the glory. Amen.
Well, brother, as I say, I'm like you. I love all God's creatures. I may not like them all or like what they do, but there's some that I sincerely love, and you're one of them. You are more than a friend. You've been a brother, and I just thank God every day for people like you in my life, because I could not accomplish my dream to help other people with this platform if it weren't for you. So thank you so much. Much love to you. And, man, I can't keep up with you on the court, and I certainly can't keep up with you in the closet. But I'm not going to try on the court, but I'm going to keep trying in the closet, man.
Oh, you doing it with that closet. I watch you when we have our banquet, how you come with them pinstripes. You sharp enough. Amen. Amen.
And then real quick funny story. I was on another show talking about the sudden death of someone, and when I left, the host at the time mentioned my name. Someone called Mr. Horton and say, did I hear it right that Coach McAdams passed? And Mr. Horton said no. And then when he told me, I said, well, you know what, he called the right place. He called the right place. Man, thank you so much. This has been so special to me. And I know our listeners, we had a full house, by the way. People were texting and saying, I'm trying to call and get in, but I can't. I said, hey, we're all locked up. But, hey, man, appreciate you. Love you.
I love
and
you
I
too,
guarantee
Coach. You know,
I will not let you down. I will continue to issue your marching orders to tell our story. And you told a large part of our story and your story this evening. Thanks, my brother.
Thank you, sir. God bless you. Everyone out there, God bless you all. Okay.
All right, folks. And this was special. I know you enjoyed it. Tremendous story. A life of just one of the greatest human beings you will ever meet. Randolph Horton, a.k.a. Reds Bowman. Well, again, I want to thank him for making this show possible. That's Horton's Funeral Service. Again, they're located 600 Kennedy Street. Their number is 202-829-9000. And then Dr. Edward T. Buford, one of the premier dentists in the D.C. area. He's at 202-667-8818. He's on U Street right next to Ben's Chili Bowl and the African American Athlete.com. My producer, Rick Hampton, thank you once again for making us sound awesome. Well, folks, next Monday, next show coming up at 7 p.m., we will have in the Coach's Corner Jeff Baxter, Carolyn, University of Maryland,
Amen.
And the
Amen.
Roommate
yeah.
of Lynn Bias will visit in the Coach's Corner. But until then, make good decisions because life is hard, but it's even harder when you're stupid. And we'll see you next time.